Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily, 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English Branch in Washington. Today on the program, we'll tell you about how gene therapy is being used to create individual treatments for people who have cancer. Then, as we always do on Mondays, we will bring you the technology report. This week, we'll tell you about a new, supersized body scanner that will let doctors look into the human body in greater detail than ever before.
And we've never really been able to interrogate that with imaging before, and now we're going to be able to look at that.
And finally, as we do every weekday, we will present The Making of a Nation. So, you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Cancer is one of the world's most feared diseases, and with good reason. It is the leading cause of death throughout the world. Every year, about 14 million people are diagnosed with cancer. That is about the same number of people who live in the city of Los Angeles, California. Many are treated with powerful medicines, but the side effects can be difficult to deal with. Others have surgery. The American Cancer Society says in the United States, more men and women between 40 and 79 die of cancer than from any other cause. But now comes news about a new way to fight cancer. Our Mary Gottschall reports cancer expert Dr. William Nelson says a new therapy that works with an individual's genes will soon be deployed in the fight against the disease.
Cancer is one of the world's most feared diseases, and with good reason. It's the leading cause of death across the globe. Every year, about 14 million people are diagnosed with cancer. That's roughly the population of Los Angeles. Many are treated with powerful medicines, using chemotherapy. But the side effects can be as difficult as the disease. Others have surgery to combat the disease. In the U.S., it is the leading cause of death for men and women aged 40 to 79 years old, reports the American Cancer Society. But a new therapy that works with an individual's genes is on the horizon, says cancer expert William Nelson, MD, PhD. Nelson is director of the Kimmel Cancer Center at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland. It is ranked as one of America's top cancer research facilities, according to the National Cancer Institute. Precision medicine is a new field of medicine that works with an individual's variations in genes, environment, and lifestyle, reports the National Institutes of Health. NIH is a federal research center for medicine in Bethesda, Maryland. It is a fast-growing area of medicine. Nelson said almost every U.S. hospital and healthcare center is promoting precision medicine as a service. In addition, President Obama launched a national precision medicine initiative in January this year. The U.S. government funded it with $215 million. The White House said the program will speed up medical discoveries and give doctors new tools, knowledge, and therapies. This will tailor treatments to the individual. Precision medicine can be a powerful tool in cancer treatment. Nelson explained that cancer happens when genes behave abnormally. A process called gene sequencing can make a map of all the cells in the body. Researchers can find genes that have mutated. Mutated genes cause cancer. Technology speeds up the process of mapping genes. Nelson said the microprocessor power is doubling every 18 months. This is an important change from the way cancer drugs were developed before. In the past, Nelson said, cancer drugs were discovered by experiments in a lab. For example, scientists might discover a plant in the Amazon rainforest and test it in a lab to see if it could kill cancer cells. But only 4% to 5% of cancer drugs discovered this way had any meaningful benefit. In 15 years of cancer research, only 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 drugs proved to be helpful, according to the cancer expert. "We weren't getting where we needed to go fast enough," Nelson told the audience. Plus, it was expensive. The pharmaceutical companies were spending an average of $1 billion to $2 billion to create a new drug. And a lot of these new drugs simply did not work, according to Nelson. But then, in the late 1990s, the discovery of gene sequencing changed all that. Pharmaceutical companies began creating new cancer drugs to stop the specific gene mutations found in different cancers. For example, Herceptin was developed in 1998 to treat breast cancer. Glovec was developed to treat leukemia. "We're in a business where we have to know what the gene mutations are to defeat them," said Nelson. As a result, there has been an accelerating pace of anti-cancer drugs, discovery, development, and approval, continued Nelson. The Food and Drug Administration approves all new drugs in the U.S. The FDA approved 12 anti-cancer drugs in 2013, 10 in 2014, and 8 so far in 2015. Compare that to only 2 anti-cancer drugs that were approved by the FDA from 2008 to 2012. Nelson said a new drug called nivolumab may recognize gene defects in each individual and unleash the immune system to attack the cancer. The gene test will ultimately save insurers money because this will lead to a more efficient, targeted approach to cancer treatment, concluded Nelson. I'm Mary Gottschall.
That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. The Technology Report and the Making of a Nation are coming up next. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. For all of the women and men of the Voice of America all around the world, and for all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. Scientists are developing a medical device that could tell them more about the human body and help them develop more effective treatments for cancer, heart disease, and brain disorders. It would be the world's first full-body PET scanner. PET stands for positron emission tomography. PET scanners create 3D images of what is happening in the body. Researchers are calling the large scanner that they are developing Explorer. It will give medical workers images of what is happening in the entire human body that have never been seen before. PET scanners now give doctors images of only parts of the body. The U.S. National Institutes of Health gave a research team at the University of California at Davis $15.5 million to build the scanner. Ramzi Badawi is a professor of radiology at UC Davis. He says the scanner will give researchers new information about how human organs work together.
We're a system of organs, and all the organs interact with each other. And we've never really been able to interrogate that with imaging before, and now we're going to be able to look at that.
X-rays and MRIs give images of bones and organs. PET scans show doctors how organs and tissues are working on a molecular level. These images help them identify and follow diseases. The new scanner will help them do that even better. Simon Cherry is a professor of biomedical engineering at UC Davis. He says the PET scans can show the progress of both disease and medical treatments.
With PET scans, we're looking at function. We're actually able to say something about what the cells in the body are doing, how actively they're metabolizing, for example, or how quickly they're dividing. Taking a cancer example, that can be tremendously powerful to see if, when you give a drug, whether it shuts down the metabolism of the tumor.
PET scans use a radioactive substance to find tumors. Professor Cherry says the Explorer uses a much lower amount of radiation than current PET tests and creates images more quickly.
So we could do scans in maybe 30 seconds that currently take 20 minutes, or we could drop the radiation dose significantly and do scans at a fraction of the radiation dose that we currently do them at.
A complete view could help researchers develop new medicines that target diseases and parts of the body. It could help doctors reduce harmful side effects by following the movement of medicines through the body. The researchers hope to test the Explorer with humans in 3 years. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. For more technology stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Welcome to the making of a nation. Surrender finally came for General Robert E. Lee and the Confederacy he had served as a great soldier. It was mostly his military skill and intelligence that kept the South in the field so long. But even his extraordinary skill could not save the South from the industrial power of the North and its mighty armies, armies that were well-fed and well-equipped. This week in our series, Stuart Spencer and Leo Scully continue the story of the American Civil War.
The last chapter of the bitter four-year struggle came in April 1865. General Grant had pushed Lee's army away from Richmond and nearby Petersburg, Virginia. His Union forces had kept after the Confederates for almost a week. Lee fled westward across Virginia. His tired, hungry soldiers tried to turn south, to reach safety in the Carolinas. But always, the Union Army blocked the way. Finally, on Saturday, April 8th, Lee's army found it could flee no farther. A Union force at Appomattox Station blocked any further movement to the west. Early the next morning, Lee tried to break through the ring of Union soldiers that surrounded his army, but he failed. Nothing was left, nothing but surrender.
Lee sent a note to General Grant, asking to meet with him to discuss surrender terms. A few hours later, General Grant rode into the crossroads village of Appomattox Courthouse. General Lee was waiting for him at the home of a man named Wilmer McLean. Lee rose as Grant walked into the house. Grant did not look like a great military leader, the chief of all Union armies. He was dressed simply. His clothes were the same as those worn by the lowest soldiers in his army. His boots and pants were covered with mud. His blue coat was dirty and wrinkled. But on its shoulders were the three gold stars of the Union's highest general.
Lee was dressed in his finest clothing. He wore a beautiful gray coat with a red sash tied around it. At his side, he carried an ivory and silver sword. The two generals greeted each other and shook hands. Grant said, "I met you once before, General Lee, while we were serving in Mexico. I have always remembered your appearance. I think I would have recognized you anywhere." Lee said, "Yes, I know I met you then, and I have often tried to remember how you looked, but I have never been able to remember a single feature."
Grant continued to talk of their service in the Mexican War. He said later that he did so because he was finding it difficult to bring up the question of surrender. Lee took part in the light talk for several minutes. Finally, he said, "I suppose, General Grant, that the purpose of our meeting is fully understood. I asked to see you to learn upon what terms you would receive the surrender of my army." Grant answered, "The terms I propose are those I offered in my earlier note to you. That is, the officers and men surrendered will not take up arms again, and all your weapons and supplies will become captured property."
Lee said those were the conditions he had expected, He asked Grant to put the terms in writing so he could sign them. "Very well," said Grant. "I will write them out." It took him several minutes to write the surrender agreement. Only once did he look up. He had just written the sentence, "The arms, artillery, and public property will be given over to the Union Army." Grant stopped writing and looked over at the sword the old general wore. He decided there was no need to hurt Lee's pride by taking away his sword. So he added, "This will not include the sidearms of the officers, nor their horses, or other private property. Each officer and man shall be allowed to return to his home. He will not be disturbed by United States authorities as long as he honors this agreement and obeys the laws where he lives."
Grant gave the paper to Lee. Lee read it slowly. When he finished, Grant asked if the Confederate general wished to propose any changes. Lee was silent for a moment. "There is one thing," he said. "The cavalrymen and artillerymen in our army own their own horses. I would like to understand if these men will be allowed to keep their horses." "You will find," Grant said, "that the terms as written do not allow it. Only the officers are permitted to take their private property." "You are correct," said Lee. "I see the terms do not allow it. That is clear."
Until now, Lee's face had shown no emotion. But for a moment, his self-control weakened. Grant could see how badly Lee wanted this. "Well," said Grant, "I did not know that any private soldiers owned their horses. But I think that this will be the last battle of the war. I sincerely hope so. I think that the surrender of this army will be followed soon by that of all the others. I take it that most of your soldiers are small farmers and will need the horses to put in a crop that will carry themselves and their families through the next winter. I will not change the terms as they are written, but I will tell my officers to let all the men who claim to own a horse or mule take the animals home with them to work their little farms."
Lee was pleased with this. He told Grant, "This will have the best possible effect upon the men. It will be very gratifying and will do much to help our people." While waiting for the surrender papers to be copied, Grant presented Lee to the other Union officers in the room. Lee had known some of them before the war. After a few minutes, Lee turned to Grant. He told him that his army held about 1,000 Union soldiers as war prisoners. He said that for the past few days, he had no food but cracked corn to give them. He said he had nothing to give his own men to eat. Grant called in his supply officer and ordered him to feed the Confederate army. He told him to send to Lee's army enough food for 25,000 men.
Finally, the surrender papers were ready. Grant and Lee signed them. Lee shook hands with Grant and walked out of the house. Lee got on his horse and rode slowly back to his army. As he entered Confederate lines, men began to cheer, but the cheering died when the soldiers saw the pain and sorrow in Lee's face. Tears filled the old man's eyes. He could not speak. Soldiers removed their hats and watched silently as Lee rode past. Many wept.
A crowd of soldiers waited at Lee's headquarters. They pushed close around him, trying to touch him, trying to shake his hand. Lee began to speak. "Boys, I have done the best I could for you. Go home now. And if you make as good citizens as you have soldiers, you will do well. I shall always be proud of you. Goodbye, and God bless you all." From the crowd came a loud cry. "Farewell, General Lee. I wish for your sake and mine that every damned Yankee on earth was sunk 10 miles in hell."
On the other side of the lines, Union soldiers began to celebrate. Artillerymen fired their guns to salute the victory over Lee. Grant heard the artillery booming and sent orders that it should stop. "The rebels are our countrymen again," he said. "We can best show our joy by refusing to celebrate their downfall."
General Grant left Appomattox Courthouse to return to his headquarters a few kilometers away. Suddenly, he stopped his horse. He had forgotten to tell President Lincoln or War Secretary Stanton that Lee had surrendered. He sat down at the side of the road and wrote a telegram to Secretary Stanton. News of the surrender reached Washington late on Sunday. Most citizens in the capital did not learn of it until early the next morning. Then cannons began to boom out over the city. Crowds rushed to the White House to cheer the president. They asked Lincoln to make a victory speech. Lincoln said he had not prepared a statement. He wished to wait until the next night. He asked the people to come back then, and he would have something to say.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Stuart Spencer and Leo Scully.